You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Mireya Solis. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings, and it'll be my pleasure to host our panel discussion today. And let me just start by introducing some of the topics. Why is this so important, such a pressing issue to be talking about this afternoon? As you all know, Japan today faces a fundamental question. What will be its energy future? In the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear crisis, a lot of Japanese people felt that they could not put their faith that nuclear power could be supplied in a safe manner. And they have gone to the streets to ask for a nuclear phase-out. The Japanese government seemed to lean in that direction when on September 14th, the Energy and Environment Council announced a new energy plan that endorsed the idea of a zero nuclear Japan by the year 2040. But just a few days later, we learned that the Japanese cabinet refused from endorsing that goal of zero nuclear for Japan. And we also know that there are a few reactors still under construction and that therefore they could still be operational past that 2040 deadline. There is also a lot of concern as to what would be the future of this spent fuel reprocessing facility in Aomori if Japan were to go completely off nuclear. And the latest back and forth of the past couple of days has been between the newly established Nuclear Regulation Authority and the central government on who actually in Japan will make the decision on when to restart reactors that have met those critical stress tests. Each party says that it's the other's responsibility. So to say that we have a very confusing picture in front of us is clearly an understatement. And the fundamental question still remains. What could be the appropriate, the right energy mix that helps Japan reconcile a number of very important priorities, things that we would all like to see accomplished? How could that be done with one energy mix? First of all, public acceptance that the safety concerns have been met. Second, a reliable and cost-effective supply of energy so that the Japanese economy can maintain its competitiveness. And third, Japan's adherence to its international commitments on climate change goals. So, because we would like to have some more clarity of where Japan stands today, where Japan is going in terms of its energy future, we have gathered a very distinguished panel of experts today. You have the bio. It has been distributed in a handout, so I'm not going to go through very lengthy discussions. Let me just briefly announce who they are. So we have Mr. Toshikazu Okuya, who's a special advisor to METI and the director of the JETRO office in New York. We have Dr. Llewellyn Hughes, assistant professor at George Washington University. Mr. Scott Campbell, director of the Howard Baker Forum. And Dr. Charles Ebinger, director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings. Now, from the outset, I'm going to tell you that I've been very unfair to the panelists because I have asked them to cover very difficult, complex issues, and I've given them 10 minutes each. But the idea here is that we want to have a lot of discussion. There is a lot of debate going on, and we want to capture all of that and therefore leave a lot of time for your opinions, for your questions, for your comments. So let me tell my fellow panelists that when you see me raise a white piece of paper, that means that you have 1 minute left. And when I raise it for the second time, it's not a peace offering, but actually is that you have to conclude. No, this is not the Jim Lehrer Mall. When I say it's enough, it's enough. It's just, you have to stop. All right, thank you so much. So Mr. Okuya, if you want to go first, and I think that the panelists are going to step down so we are not in the way for the PowerPoint. Thank you.
I would like to show the pictures. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to make a presentation today. And I appreciate Maria to arrange this exciting conference. So I look forward to have a discussion with my friends, the panelists, and the people joining to conference. And I would like to start my presentation, but it doesn't work. So, excuse me. So before starting the explanation about the Japanese energy policy, so I would like to share the background condition about the Japanese energy policy. And after that, I would like to explain the direction of Japanese energy policy. So I would like to share the background condition about Japan. So that this machine cannot read my material. So that now, so the stars take pictures. So this slide about a global energy self-sufficiency ratio situation. It's easy to understand how low Japanese energy self-sufficiency ratio is. 90%, including nuclear energy. So without nuclear energy, Japanese energy self-sufficiency ratio is less than 5%. It's easy to understand how serious Japanese energy situation is. And this is a primary energy situation in Japan. The upper chart, so the please see the left side chart, that's a before Fukushima accident situation. The nuclear energy of total primary energy is the 90%. But after Fukushima, portfolio of total primary energy in Japan is around 4%. So it means gas and oil covered the reduction of nuclear energy. And it's very clear what happened in Japan in the power generation area. This is the primary energy for generating electricity. Before Fukushima, 2010, our dependency for generating electricity from the oil and gas around 60%. But in July 2012, our dependency on the oil and gas to generate electricity is around 90%. That's the reality of Japan. So I would like to share the macroeconomic situation of Japan from energy perspective. In 2011, we had the first annual trade deficit in these three decades because of expansion of oil and gas import like this. This is a very serious problem because this is a structural problem. It's not easy to find a solution quickly. That's a background about Japanese energy policy. And as you know, on September 14th, Japanese Energy and Environmental Council under the cabinet introduced a new strategy. Title is an innovative strategy for energy and environment. The first three pillars are main agendas to manage the energy policy in Japan. And first is the realization of a society not dependent on the nuclear power. The second, realization of green energy revolution. And the third, for ensuring stable supply of energy. Also, to introduce efficiency on our electricity power supply structure, we will also do the bold implementation of reform of electric power system. And we recognize our obligation to reduce carbon emission. That's fine. And after the decision of Energy and Environmental Council, Japanese cabinet, government cabinet, introduced a cabinet decision, the future policies for the energy and the environment, on the September 19th. In the decision, government stated like this: Government of Japan will implement the future policies on energy and the environment, taking into account of the innovative strategy on energy and the environment. And we constantly review and re-examine our new energy policy direction because we have a very, very vulnerable global energy structure and the Japanese economic situations like that. We have to care about that. And this is the first pillar, realization of a society not dependent on the nuclear power. Firstly, I would like to say, because the shortage of electricity power, in the meantime, nuclear power plants whose safety is assured by new nuclear regulatory authority will be utilized as an important power source. And there are three guiding principles. The first, strict apply the stipulated rules regarding a 40-year limitation of the operation. Second, restart the operation of nuclear power plants once the nuclear regulatory authority gives safety assurance. The third, not to plan the new and additional construction of a nuclear power plant. There are five policies. First one, nuclear fuel cycle policy. Many people have a concern about that, maybe. We will continue our present nuclear fuel cycle policy. And we have to keep the close relationship with international community and local people to manage this problem. And also, we have to maintain and strengthen the human resource how to manage nuclear energy policy and the technology to make a contribution in the world to use the nuclear energy. And the cooperation with the international community and the local people. And the third, the strategy mentioned touch upon the review of the past about this strategy. Because, as I mentioned, there are a lot of uncertainty in not only Japan, but also world, how to secure our energy supply in Japan. So we will constantly review and re-examine our energy policy. And regarding green energy revolution, there are two agendas. Firstly, energy savings. From 1973 to 2009, Japanese GDP increased 2.3 times. And energy consumption in consumer sector, individual sector, increased 2.4 times. On the other hand, transportation sector's energy consumption increased 1.9 times, below GDP growth. And in industrial sector, their consumption increased 0.8 5 times. It means industrial sector succeeded in reducing energy consumption from 1973. So it means we succeeded primary energy consumption per GDP improved 33% from 1979. We made a best effort to conserve the energy use. But on the other hand, we have to push our effort more and more so that we introduce a very complicated structure to energy, to conserve the energy. We introduce an energy conservation law, so this gives an obligation to each sector. Also, we introduce a tax and budget to push conservation. This is the image of expansion of energy saving. We would like to complete by 2030 to reach at 19% of energy consumption reduction. And the second agenda in green energy revolution is a renewable. In 2003, actually, Japanese government and METI started imposing an obligation to utility companies to introduce a certain amount of renewable energy. So because of that, from 2003 to the present, renewable amount of renewable in power sector doubled, has doubled. But on the other hand, only 1% of total primary energy for power generation. It's not enough. So because of that, we introduced a feed-in tariff system. And that system started from the July 1st, 2012. This is the structure of feed-in tariff, sorry. And actually, so we estimate that we will be able to add 2.5 gigawatt from renewable in 2012 fiscal year. And this is an image of expansion of renewable. We would like to reach out the 300 billion kilowatt per hour by 2030 from renewable, from 110 billion. And ensuring stable supply of energy. Yes, we have, as I mentioned, from the trade deficit situation, we have no room to buy expensive gas and oil from the world. On the other hand, we have to strengthen the diversity of the resources for Japan. So it means we discuss with you, the American friends, and the Canadian friends, Australian friends, Russian friends, like that. And in APEC Brazil stock meeting in last September, Japan and Russia introduced agreement that Japan will support to introduce a new liquefaction facility in Brazil stock in Russia. And also, how to use effectively heat is one of the big questions, so that we will also push a cogeneration. And, how to use the effectively the electricity is big question. Japan has a vertical electricity supply structure, so we have to introduce more efficiency in the structure. We will push. And on the other hand, we have to pay attention to the cost structure to generate power to manage well the Japanese economic performance. So there are a lot of problems, and I'm sorry to use a long time. Thank you very much.
You are? Oh, I didn't realize. Oh, there's another PowerPoint. Oh. All right, thank you so much, Mr. Okuya, for a very interesting presentation. Now we're going to move to Dr. Hughes' presentation. He's also going to use a PowerPoint.
Okay. I PDF'd this guy, so it should work. View. Okay. Thanks very much. So it's a delight to be here. Thanks, Media, for putting today's panel together. Really a very timely topic. What I wanted to do in the 10 minutes or so I have initially is to make three pretty brief points. Firstly, that for the first time, I think, for 40 years, or actually probably even longer, really everything is on the table in terms of Japan's energy sector reform. That is, in previous periods, we've seen pieces of what's been proposed here discussed. In the 1990s and the 2000s, Japan carried out limited liberalization of its power sector, particularly at the retail level. In the 1980s and the 1990s, we saw cost being a significant, or reducing cost being a significant driver of oil market liberalization. In the 1970s, we saw obviously big investments through subsidies and other measures to try and promote the role of nuclear energy. But if you look at what the DPJ has proposed, although this is contested, as Mr. Okuya pointed out, all of those things have been put on the table at the same time. So it's a very ambitious agenda. The second point I want to make is that it's the process through which the DPJ reached this conclusion looks very, very different to the way that Japan has typically gone about carrying out its internal discussions over the design and implementation of energy policy. It's actually shifted from what I like to call a process of quiet politics to a much noisier model in which there are more voices and it's far less insulated from the types of discussions that have gone on before. The third point is perhaps the most important, and that is what's going to stick. That is, you can see a lot of different proposals being put on the table, and there's a question about whether this is really just about electoral politics or whether there's something which is likely to stay from this proposal in the medium to long term. It's not an exaggeration, I think, to say that the DPJ's proposal, which has come out of their national policy unit for the energy sector, is a pretty radical reimagining of Japan's energy sector. It drew great public interest in the public consultation period of the review, which took about a year. They received 90,000 submissions from organizations and individuals who were interested in giving their thoughts on what to do post March 11, 2011, about Japan's energy mix. And the main conclusions Mr. Okiya introduced to us. Broadly, the most important and probably the headline is that the proposal suggests that Japan should vastly reduce the role of nuclear power in its energy mix. Now, nuclear power has been the absolute core of the way that Japan has gone about managing its energy security and its environmental and its kind of competitiveness issues which have driven its energy policy in the post-war period. In order to reduce the role of nuclear power, they've suggested not introducing a 40-year limit to the operation of units, nuclear units, and not extending those. Also, not allowing the reconstruction or the expansion of existing units. So we'll see a gradual reduction in the role of nuclear power over time, and replacing that with three measures. The first of those is to increase the role of thermal, that is gas and coal, as well as renewable energy sources, as Mr. Okiya talked about. Secondly, pretty aggressive targets over the next 10 to 20 years in demand management, particularly in the residential sector. And then lastly, in order to try and promote the uptake of renewables, a comprehensive reform of Japan's electricity sector, right? That means full retail liberalization and also the potential breakup or the separation of transmission from generation. Japan currently has regional monopolies. Pretty radical. How did it come about? So the process through which the DPJ reached this conclusion plays, although it can look messy, I think that if you were to summarize it, then it plays off, it uses the same playbook that Prime Minister Koizumi used, that indeed Prime Minister Hashimoto used, that is that previous activist prime ministers have tried to use when they've tried to implement significant microeconomic reform into Japan's economy. Okay, that means that they have avoided the kind of bottom-up decision-making structure that's been, and I'll give you an example of this in a moment, that's being dominated by people who have a stake in the existing system. And they've tried to shift outside that by actively introducing new voices and by shifting the location of decision-making. Okay, we can see this going on in Washington with Congress with the deficit discussion, for example. Where you choose to make the decision produces a very different kind of outcome in terms of policy, and that's exactly the strategy that the current government has tried to use. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this. It's probably long enough ago now that I can say this without all of you throwing rotten fruit at me. But 10 or 12 years ago, I guess now, I was based in Japan working for a firm that was pushing electricity liberalization in Japan, and most members of that firm who turned out not quite to be the smartest guys in the room after all. And the reason that we lost that debate was because of the California mess, and probably our own incompetence to some degree as well. But it was also because it was very difficult to get a voice in the system. Okay. Why was that the case? Because you had a very bottom-up decision-making structure, which was handled in a technocratic manner, and which moved forwards in an incremental way over a fairly long period of time. Okay, and that's been the basic decision-making structure for a microeconomic reform, for structural reform for Japan for a long time now. Okay, what it tends to produce is incrementalism. If you shift forward if we characterize that as quiet politics, and we shift forward to the way that the DPJ went about trying to put this proposal together, it's much more akin to a noisy political process. As I said, borrowing from the kind of strategies which the previous LDP administrations have actually used. That is, expanding the role of the cabinet, giving a special minister within cabinet the key role in driving reform from the top down. Okay, in explicitly choosing to insert new voices into the kind of market design issues. So, for example, I'll give you a couple of examples. If you look, for example, at the expert committee, which did the initial proposal on power sector reform, it looks very different to the committee which drove it 10 years ago. 10 years ago, there was a single new market entrant who sat on the committee, but most of the other members were from either the existing utilities or from people who had a stake in debate. What you saw in the proposal generation process for the DPJ was the inclusion of economists, the inclusion of legal scholars who have done a lot of work on antitrust, investment analysts, and so on and so forth. So it's a very different makeup of the in terms of committee membership, and it's not surprising, given that they reached fairly radical proposals relative to what has been put in place before. The other way in which new voices have been inserted, or indeed have inserted themselves into the energy debate, is through public opinion. It's no surprise that the Japanese public have been concerned about the role of nuclear power in this nuclear village that you keep reading about in the press. So the DPJ carried out a fairly comprehensive survey of public opinion, and you can see that a majority, this is the data from newspaper polling 6 months after the disaster. You can see a large number of people wanted to reduce or remove the role of nuclear energy. In the survey data from July of this year, that number has reduced somewhat, but there's still a majority of the public who want to significantly reduce, let's say, the role of nuclear energy. And this was used in a way of justifying the types of conclusions that the government reached over this proposal. So my third point is trying to answer the question of what's likely to stick here. That is, we've seen a very radical proposal for reducing the role of nuclear power and replacing it with thermal renewables and a whole raft of demand management measures. We've already seen contentiousness. Okay, the cabinet on September the 19th, refused to openly rubber stamp or put their hanko on the agreement which was reached in September the 14th. We've seen Mr. Furukawa, who was one of the strong proponents and drove this process forward, not included in the new cabinet, which has been put together by the Prime Minister. And we have an election coming up. Okay, and if you look at the LDP and the people who are supporting Mr. Abe, there are strong supporters of the utilities and of the existing energy structure within the kind of core LDP leadership now. Having said that, it's my opinion that we're not going to return to the status quo ex ante. And the reason for that is because I think that a lot of what has been included, if you remove the headline figures, a lot of what has been included in this proposal has actually already been implemented, or it represents some kind of consensus between the political parties. That is, regardless of who wins government, we're going to see a similar set of measures introduced. I've been given my second flag wave of death, so let me be quick here. Okay. If we're looking at the reduction in the role of nuclear power on the supply side, for example, okay, the law establishing the Nuclear Safety Commission, Article 43.331, states that unit operations should be limited to 40 years. But during negotiations with the LDP over passing the law through the upper house, a clause was inserted which allows the extension of those units for 20 years if safety procedures are met. So in a way, we have a law. Laws are harder to pass in Japan than the United States at the moment. So this is established in law, and it represents some kind of consensus between the parties, which doesn't say 40 years. It actually says 40 to 60 years per unit, and that moves us well past the 2030 date. Okay. Now, when the rubber is going to hit the road with this is going to be when Kansai Electric, a large number of their units are going to come up for 40 years in this decade. So how that is negotiated and whether the Nuclear Safety Commission extends the life of those reactors is going to be one signal we need to look for. This is my last slide. And the second area, I think, where there's general consensus is over the broad implementation of a feed-in tariff system in order to promote the development of renewables. Okay, solar feed-in tariffs were implemented by the LDP administration, expanded by the DPJ. Okay, and there's reasonably strong support amongst the solar industry and increasingly amongst Japanese producers of wind turbines for these very, very attractive rates. In fact, I'd provide some advice to a firm called GR Japan, who do public affairs in Japan, and they've received a lot of calls of interest about this particular scheme and how people can make some money on it. So to conclude, there are big areas of dispute. There are big areas of agreement, and perhaps we can talk more about the areas of dispute during Q&A. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hugh. So now we move on, and Mr. Campbell, if you could go next, please.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Solis, and thank you to Brookings for having us here today. This is a very, very timely panel discussion, as our large group demonstrates, and I think Brookings has to be congratulated. They proved to be extremely agile in staying on top of breaking developments in energy, largely thanks to Charlie Ebinger here. This session is a very good example of that. In the world of energy, it's always something, right? It's one disruptive event, technology, or policy after another. It's a war in Iraq. It's the Iranian nuclear bomb threat, the shale energy revolution, and now we have Japan's zero nuclear option. And these developments are always global in their repercussions. If Japan were to quit nuclear power, it will be hugely disruptive, and we shouldn't kid ourselves about it. The zero option, of course, as Mr. Okuya and Llewellyn have pointed out, is not official, but it has the potential to do two things, to handicap the world's largest economy and undermine 50 years plus of U.S.-Japan partnership in nuclear energy, with consequences for Japanese and Americans. We have to remember that Japan is the single most important partner to the United States in nuclear energy. It's in nuclear diplomacy, in maintaining, the NPR. I don't mean Big Bird and Jim Lehrer. I'm talking about the non-proliferation regime, of course. And in nuclear commerce, extremely important. International power markets, the U.S., U.S. companies, Japanese companies consistently and very often partner to meet the global demand for nuclear power plants around the world. We may not have a nuclear renaissance in the United States, but there is one going on around the world, and many new power plants will be built over the years. American companies, Japanese companies want to be there, but it could be quite difficult if Japan zeroes out nuclear power. Now, for about 5 years now, I've served as a director of the U.S.-Japan Roundtable on Nuclear Energy. It's a public policy platform for U.S. and Japanese companies who do business in the nuclear space. Members include companies from all sides and all phases of the nuclear power industry from the very beginning to the end. The roundtable gives me a window, if you will, on the experiences and the views and the concerns of both U.S. and Japanese companies, and I think they're interesting. In this case, it's the view of many roundtable members that the zero nuclear option threatens the very underpinning of the U.S.-Japan partnership to assure a safe and secure nuclear expansion in the world, which is coming. Many observers, including our members and some of our experts, fear that the world will become a very dangerous place with the U.S. and Japan barely able to compete, not real players in the nuclear game. Something is likely to happen if we really, if Japan zeroes out nuclear power. But, of course, the zero option is not a done deal. As you will hear from our, as you heard from Okuya-san and Llewellyn, much is in turmoil and flux. But I would argue, and I think our members, many of them believe, that in fact the zero option is not even achievable, given the practical realities of for Japan, a major economic power, an export economy without indigenous resources in a competitive global market where energy costs are an important component of the cost of manufacture. The zero option may seem like good politics to the DPJ, but I doubt that it's good policy. And if you ask our members, they'll tell you that they'll give you about six reasons why it's not. And they are. Number one, it's too costly. Importing LNG and relying on renewables is too costly for an export economy. You know, the trade deficit, as we saw in a moment ago in Okuya-san's slides, soared in the first half of 2012. They have a record trade deficit now approaching $32.1 billion, five times greater than the deficit a year earlier. The energy cost of manufacturing will push up export prices of export items at a time in which Japan's automobile industry is being challenged by the Koreans. 8.4% in Hyundai sales, I think you bought one, and Toyota down 1.31% in sales. There are a lot of reasons for that, obviously, but it certainly doesn't help to make your the cost of production more expensive because of rapidly increasing energy prices. Number two, the zero option doesn't work because renewables are inadequate. This will be an unpopular thought, but wind, solar, and biofuels are too expensive and lack the energy density to adequately supply the power needed. Now, we may find that they make an important contribution over time. They can make a contribution, but in the near term, hardly. I know Chris Flavin was here from the World Watch. He would say the Germans are nuclear-free, and they get it done, but they can rely on Russian gas to their pipeline and the French nuclear-powered electricity. The Japanese do not have ready access to Russian gas via pipelines or our French next door. And number three, the zero option doesn't work for Japan because it undercuts Japan's progress in combating global warming. And I think Okuya-san pointed that out. Japan can't meet its Kyoto targets with greater dependence on LNG, which I think will be necessary. The Kyoto protocols call for 25% reduction by 2020, and with an average of 6% a year, I think they're seeing a 17% increase. It was in March 2011 to March 2012, they saw a jump. Obviously, they emitted 439 million tons of CO2, a big increase over the previous year. And I think there's been one government study so far by the Japanese government that says that the best they could do is maybe 16% reduction instead of 25. So it inhibits and hurts their attempt to deal with climate change. Number four, the zero option reduces Japan's standing, its geopolitical influence in the world. I think important for a nation of its size and importance for our world economy. It weakens Japan's leadership role in the global nuclear renaissance and related nonproliferation efforts, therefore weakens an important ally of the United States in those regards. The basic bottom line, I think, is that both for the United States and Japan, if you're not an industry leader, you're not going to be at the table in the future. The proliferation regime, the rules of the game, nuclear game, in a period of rapid expansion in developing countries around the world, many without a safety culture, this becomes a very reckless and risky proposition, at least from some perspectives. Number five, the zero option hurts the American nuclear enterprise. We're hearing this from American companies. U.S. nuclear companies are owned or they're in partnership with or suppliers to Japan's nuclear industry. It used to be the other way around. But we now lean heavily on the Japanese industry, to which the zero option is a crippling blow. How do you sell reactors abroad if you can't place them in your own country? The U.S. brand is largely carried to the world by Japan. Toshiba owns Westinghouse, as you know. GE partners with Hitachi. So we see, our members see, it hurting U.S. competitiveness, loss of sales here as well as in Japan, and eventually loss of jobs at a time when we're very sensitive to that. And finally, number six, zero option doesn't make a lot of sense to, at least to our members. Both countries lose the next generation of human capital when it comes to nuclear expertise in both countries. Very, very important at a time of nuclear expansion worldwide. And that we already have an aging nuclear skilled workforce. It disappears. The younger men and women go to China, Korea, and Russia. We're already reading the Japanese press about a brain drain. Apparently, the Chinese, the Koreans, and the Chinese are offering between 50 million and 60 million yen per year to nuclear engineers in Japan. There's real concern of a loss of human capital. China and India alone plan to build 80 and 70 new nuclear power plants, respectively, by 2020. That's a $1.9 trillion market by some estimates, something that Japan would miss out on, an enormous economic opportunity for Japan and concomitantly for the United States. So at the end of the day, the zero option probably won't take effect. It would be my argument because it doesn't make sense for Japan. And in closing, I would commend it to the Japanese government and all those policymakers who have to make this decision as they go through this long process, the advice of Governor Bobby Jindal, Governor of Louisiana, during the BP deepwater oil crisis, you'll recall. He warned his president had begun a six-month moratorium on offshore drilling, which is now lapsed and is no longer called for. But he warned us, don't turn an environmental disaster into an economic catastrophe. Good advice for Japan as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Campbell. And now we move to Charlie Evinger, please.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to keep my presentation short because Mr. Campbell covered a lot of the points I would agree with. But before beginning, I want to congratulate Dr. Solis. For those of you who don't know, she's our newly installed head of our Japan chair, and this is really her first formal event, and I think she's done a marvelous job getting both other good speakers and such a distinguished audience. So congratulations. I'm going to pick up on the point of what happens if Japan goes the zero option in terms of the global regime for both commercial nuclear power and nonproliferation. Because I am deeply concerned that Japan has not addressed the question or rectified the stark differences that obviously occur from the new policy if it is implemented, on how, on the one hand, they move to back off of commercial nuclear power, and yet, on the other hand, having been in the forefront of research for commercial nuclear reprocessing and plutonium recycle, what happens to that? They have been, you know, albeit with problems, albeit at a very high cost to Japanese society, but they have been, along with the French, in the forefront of trying to prove that the nuclear waste from the conventional fuel cycle can be recycled with the depleted uranium and the plutonium created in the once-through cycle recycled for productive use in a world economy of the future. And I would worry that if, along with the zero option, that ultimately reprocessing gets knocked out as well, we will lose a tremendous opportunity for the future, albeit perhaps the very long future of a next generation of nuclear fuels. Now, I know that's a very controversial statement that many would disagree with it, but I think it's something to think about. And the point Mr. Campbell made about Japan's leading role along with the United States in the global nonproliferation regime, I think we have to seriously think about if Japan backs out of the nuclear market, and I think they have to, because I don't think if they don't have the maintenance market for the existing reactors or that slowly erodes, and no new reactors coming in, they aren't going to keep up the technological lead that they have historically helped the world to do with Generation 3, Generation 3 Plus, and Generation 4 reactors on the horizon. And I think, as Mr. Campbell said, it's very likely that this will not be good news for GE and Westinghouse and other smaller nuclear vendors in the United States, given the links they have with Japan's nuclear industry in terms of remaining competitive in the international nuclear marketplace. So I can envisage, if the zero option went into effect, that we effectively have a world of nuclear commerce in the future, because a lot of countries, as was alluded to, are embarking on nuclear power plants, whether we like it or not, led by such countries as South Korea, China, Russia, perhaps India, and a handful of others, all predominantly state-owned entities, which in the scramble for international nuclear commerce, I think it's at least legitimate to ask, will these countries have the same commitment to non-proliferation objectives that Japan and the United States have had over the last 40 or 50 years? We hear in the Japan model about they'll buy more LNG, that the United States is going to become a big LNG exporter, as is Australia and a handful of other countries. It's clearly the case that the United States is going to become, I hope, an LNG exporter. But if you really look at the numbers involved, it's far more sobering than some of the glossy forecasts that have come out of certain analyses. We completed a study back in May suggesting that we think it's very unlikely that there will be more than 4 BCF a day by 2020 coming out of the United States, growing to some 6 BCF by 2025. And we also show that by 2020 it will be a very difficult market. There will be great competition from Australia, from new gas supplies coming out of Mozambique, Indonesia, Malaysia, Papua New Guinea. There's going to continue to be tough competition with coal. So I think for Japan to think that coal and natural gas is going to be an easy fill the gap for nuclear power should at least be looked at much more soberly than it has to date. The one great potential, I think, looking longer term, but probably not till the 2025 period, that represents a tremendous opportunity for cooperation between our two countries would be a very substantial LNG project out of the state of Alaska. But, you know, this has also been talked about for nearly 40 years. There is movement in that direction now, but one shouldn't be too sanguine that that is going to occur. Back in 1990, Professor Sokolow at Princeton made the famous Sokolow wedge theory, in which he showed that based on the goals of the United Nations climate change reduction strategies, of what the world had to do by 2050 to have global emissions going down. And if you go back and look at his wedge theory, the growth of nuclear power was going to be huge, something in the neighborhood of 450 to 500 new nuclear power plants. And the growth of renewables was going to be huge. But as Dr. Campbell said, I question whether, if you go back and look at those numbers, whether the growth in the renewables in the pie chart that were projected, combined if renewables had to replace the loss of nuclear power in that pie chart, can do the job. And singularly, there was tremendous forecast in that pie chart about how the world was going to have carbon capture and sequestration in droves. Well, as you all know, we have almost no carbon capture and sequestration plants for coal. And while we're rushing towards natural gas in this country and elsewhere in the world with shale gas, I think we ought to remember that this is a carbon-emitting source, and at some point we've got to prove carbon capture and sequestration works for natural gas, or we're just postponing the day when the CO2 problem is going to come back to bite us. So in closing, let me say I think Japan, as a major export nation, risks becoming, as a high-cost energy producer, less competitive in global markets. I think the threats to international nuclear commerce remaining in the hands of people who have acted responsibly since the dawn of the nuclear era remains problematic, with Japan and potentially the United States becoming less significant actors. And I think we need to be very sanguine about thinking that wherever we cut back on nuclear power, not only in Japan but Germany, that somehow we're going to be able to use lots more fossil fuels and not have major implications for global climate regime. And if Japan were to get locked into more coal and LNG, what happens if down the road a global carbon tax comes into effect and all of a sudden they become a high-cost producer because they're now locked in to much greater volumes of fossil fuels? Thank you.
Thank you so much. I would like to thank the panelists for really excellent presentations and for also being very conscious about keeping their time, and that has left for us enough time to actually now have, I hope, a very spirited back and forth of questions and comments. And once I open to the floor, I know that I may not have a chance, so I want to put my two questions now, and then the floor will be yours. And my first question was really inspired by this interesting framing, I think, that Llewellyn put forward that about the noisy politics. So my question here is if that is the new normal. Have we crossed a threshold whereby now this degree of larger inclusion of public opinion will be the way in which the government conducts many of these key important decisions, or we think that over time there could be a reversion back to the more technocratic way of addressing these questions? And the second related question, but it's really for everyone in the panel, is quite simply, can the public trust be regained? I think that it was really striking to see also, Llewellyn, from your graph, that the percentage of people that said they want to reduce nuclear went down quite significantly from 90 to 50. Why is this the case? Is it just that we have to give it more time for people to learn more about the facts, or do we think that there's a hardcore view of people in Japan that will not be persuaded that nuclear power can be safe? And I say this because I think that now the government commissions that have looked at the Fukushima incident have concluded, government and non-government commissions, that it was a man-made accident. And therefore, in theory, if we were to raise the standards of security, safety, design, and so forth, we could perhaps envision a nuclear plant that's more resilient, and therefore that these public concerns could be addressed. But I'm not sure that these people can be reached. I'm not sure that they will be persuaded. There is this concern with the nuclear village, and certainly the way in which we've been hearing all kinds of things from the Japanese government lately, that doesn't create assurance that, you know, we have a very objective, coherent way of making these decisions. So I would like to collect a couple of more questions from the audience and then give the panelists an opportunity to respond and to also address each other, and then we'll go to a second round of Q&A. Is that
Mr. Is Dr. Flavin here?
Yes,
in the back. He had asked for...
For an opportunity.
I'm to make a comment.
So Mr. Flavin, please.
Thank you. Very, very, very interesting panel. I think particularly the information on the politics, the new politics in Japan, which really are revolutionary. My question is regarding the economics. You know, in my view, you know, even the nuclear phase-out plan that was put forward by the cabinet is really still, you know, very, very cautious, and I think, you know, a much slower transition than it really needs to be, based on what's happened in other countries in the world that have taken the kind of sort of ambitious commitment that Japan has taken. And, of course, you know, the most obvious example of that is Germany, which, you know, had a commitment, you know, and interestingly, it was also spurred by a nuclear catastrophe. They got a fair amount of radiation out of Chernobyl, and that was it as far as the public was concerned about nuclear in Germany. And they have taken renewables from 4% of the electricity supply in 1995 to 10% in the year 2000 and over 20% today. And almost all of that addition is either wind or solar. Now, you know, I just ask why can it be argued that Japan is not capable of doing what Germany did? I mean, they're both very, very strong industrial countries. Both have fabulous technology. Japan actually has substantially better renewable resources than Germany is really sort of third rate in terms of its resources. Japan has excellent renewable resources. Plus, Japan has relatively high electricity costs, some of the highest in the world, which makes the renewables more economical. And then here's the real clincher. Germany started to do all of this 20 years ago, when things like wind and solar were fabulously expensive. And the cost of solar just in the last 3 years has declined by two-thirds. Over that whole period, it's declined by more than 90%. And wind has probably gone down by, at least 50% over that period. So, particularly given where public opinion is in Japan, and, Japan is a democratic country. No matter what the nuclear village wants to do, I think ultimately in a democratic country, the people are going to prevail. So I just am curious as to why the Japanese government is not taking, a more ambitious, forward-looking approach here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flavin. So I'll let the panelists respond, and then we'll go for more Q&A. And I would like to ask you to please identify yourselves as I ask you to pose your question. Thank you. Reactions? Would you like to?
Regarding the introduction of the renewable. The first story, so I showed the cost structure of the each primary energy in my presentation in the last slide. Renewable still is very expensive. So, as I mentioned, in 2003, we introduced a new system. The METI gave the obligation to the utility company to introduce a certain amount of renewable. And we are trying, of course, after first oil shock and second oil shock, we started a various kind of around the project to push renewable, other energy conservation. Frankly speaking, we have an interest to introduce a renewable, no question about that. But on the other hand, so our geopolitical situation is very different from Germany, frankly speaking. In the case of Germany, they are involved into the broader grid system in Europe, and they are introducing a gas from Russia by pipeline. So the structure is very different, and to use windows, for example. So I'm not expert about that area, but we also try to introduce a window in some area. But how about efficiency and how about the cost structure is still a question. So because we have big difficulties, frankly speaking. But we try to break through the cost structure of renewable. Because of that, we decided to introduce a feed-in tariff system. So we are serious. And we introduce a feed-in tariff to introduce scale merit in renewable industry. But we need a time. Yeah, so, thank you.
So, it's a really interesting question. It's we've already had a range of different opinions put on the table. There are different ways, I guess, to answer the question, and I'm only qualified to answer some of those. There's the technological constraints. There are potential economic constraints, which was the gist of the first part of your question. There's also the kind of public policy constraints. And one of the complaints of industry groups, which represent particularly the Wind Association, that is non-solar renewables, let's say, is that they have had a difficult time in getting connection to the grid. And so part of the argument that the DPJ has made is that power sector reform is crucial to increasing the role of renewables within Japan's electricity market. That is by revitalizing the wholesale market. It does exist, but the volumes are very, very low. And so revitalizing that, including by increasing the powers of an independent regulator to regulate the management of that particular market, But I mean, that's, you know, that's one set of constraints, right, which from a kind of public policy perspective, you know, the relative bargaining power of groups which might want to shift the regulatory structure that would enable the faster uptake has traditionally been very weak within the Japanese system. The other piece of it, you know, and these are, targets are very aggressive. The subsidies are great. But there are also a whole set of problems which have been laid out associated with access to the lands where a lot of wind power projects in Hokkaido and in Tohoku, particularly Hokkaido, which is one of the areas where wind power has got the best prospects according to industry data, that there needs to be a series of regulatory changes associated with access potentially to national parks. And for geothermal, also national parks and also the kind of onsen areas and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are a number of kind of regulatory sticking points which take time to get through, aside from the market power questions, which you could also talk about. You know, perhaps Charlie or others might have a point about the, you know, the difference between nuclear running as baseload and the kind of intermittent supply that solar and wind represent. I know the government has been promoting battery technologies for a long time, for example, as their answer to that, because they're not indeed Germany and next to France's nuclear power stations.
If I could just make one quick comment. I used to actually be a wind power developer in Germany. I was vice chairman of a little Dubai-based company. And we built a wind farm in Bremerhaven in conjunction with the government. The tax credits and the green credits at that time were so generous that we amortized our investment about 13 months. Now, the Germans, and I'm not putting them down, they've done wondrous things with renewables, created new industries, and employed people, and so forth. But you hear a lot of Germans say, you know, it didn't raise tariffs for consumers. And this is true for residential consumers, mainly in small commerce. But it raised, the German government has, by last estimates, it may be higher now, has put something in the neighborhood of 70 billion euros into subsidies for wind and solar. So it's been costly somewhere along the line. Now, they made a political decision, and I think Chris is right to point out that it was perhaps a courageous one. But this idea that somehow feed-in tariffs occur without costs to somebody, if it's not an individual consumer or ratepayer, it's the federal government or the state government. And so I just want to caution that when you start talking about these very generous feed-in tariffs that Japan has, it's going to be costly to somebody in society.
Thank you. Okay, so now who would like to ask another question? Yes, please. I think we have a microphone coming your way.
Thank you. My name is Mariko Schmitz. I work for JICA. I'm also a former student of Professor Ebinger's. Just a point of clarification, Professor Ebinger, about the LNG and coal exports. You said that if there's increase in exports of LNG and coal coming out of Southeast Asia, it would be problematic for Japan to fill their gap. Now, why is that?
Excuse me. If that's what I said, I misspoke. What I was trying to say is that the market is going to be very competitive for both LNG and coal, which is the idea that everybody in Asia seems to think because we have low-cost natural gas at the wellhead that we're going to export low-cost natural gas to them. I think lower cost than they're currently paying. I would rather suggest that we'll probably export it lower than the competition, but not at a low cost. You know, if it's $14 in Japan, we aren't going to give it away at $9.75. We'll charge $12.75. And so this idea that it's going to be a cheap source, U.S. LNG exports are going to be a cheap source, I think has to be reexamined. You've got India clamoring for LNG. You've got China clamoring for LNG, increasingly Vietnam. So, you know, the price is going to be very difficult for Japan, and it's going to mean that Japan is dependent on high-cost energy imports for oil, for coal, for LNG, for going. That was the point I was trying to make.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Jennifer? Right here.
Hi, Jennifer Scleroux with George Mason University. Several of you mentioned global warming as one of the issues that would come into play in the future of Japan's energy scenario. And as Dr. Hughes mentioned, there's a new process emerging which may or may not stick in which there are voices on different sides of issues that are coming out. And so I'm wondering what you all think of the role of global warming and energy in Japan in the future, because up until now it's been a priority, but there's definitely been some press in Japan indicating that that may no longer be the case across government, industry, and the public.
Mikuya-san, we all look at you. So,
so firstly, so I have not decided a clear target how to manage the global warming issue. So that it means that we have not yet changed our position. But on the other hand, so that because of the, we cannot apply the previous conditions to Japanese present situation, so we have to think. But yeah, all panelists presented about how complicated and how serious problems we have now. So that now, I'm sorry, but I cannot provide a correct answer to you, a tangible answer. So the expansion of renewable in Japan and the accelerate energy saving is one of the way. But of course, we have already introduced one of the best system in the world. Still, in the case of renewable, maybe we have a room. So in this strategy, we mentioned that we will push the expansion of renewable. But because of the present situation, still we need a time. I'm sorry, but actual situation is like this. Yeah.
So, I might just add to that myself. No, I think we have to understand too that the debate is just getting underway. Fukushima was scared a lot of people. The polls are very adverse to nuclear power, but that will change over time, as it did with the BP offshore crisis we had. It'll take a lot longer because we learned from the BP experience that we didn't destroy the Gulf and we didn't destroy the Florida beaches, and so opinion softened. We just now have seen the business community weigh in Japan in the last month. And it did change, I think, the course of the cabinet's decision-making a bit and delayed any premature action. I think this is a long process, and the Japanese are meticulous in their decision-making. As Whelan pointed out, their sort of technocratic approach to things, a very systematic way of working issues. And I think it's going to take quite a while. Also, it remains to be seen how much damage was done. We know it was apparently human error rather than technological error, so the technology is okay. The question is, can you regain the public trust of people who manage this process? And I think that can be done over time. But the debate will continue. And I think it's a bit premature to suggest that these high anti-nuclear sentiments will stay on as people begin to factor in climate change, jobs, competitiveness, the economy, competitiveness of abroad. And I think all those factors will start coming into play, and they're just now starting to come up. It's going to take a while.
So if you look at the evidence so far, when the question has been asked about whether the government will choose competitiveness or climate, then they've fallen on the side of competitiveness rather than the climate. That is a very aggressive statement about Japan's climate targets. I think it was 25% from 1990 figures by 2020. Yeah, never going to happen, but the Japanese language is great at subclauses, and there was a subclause included in this statement which said as so long as other states also came to the party. And so there's a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card associated with taking on the economic costs with what was a very, very, overly aggressive target. If you look at the way that that climate is dealt with in the proposal, that's been put here. Once again, climate has come off second best relative to the other public policy goals. Mm-hmm. That is, coal has been included as potential baseload and replacement of nuclear power, and the way to manage the kind of criticism of the climate externalities associated with that is to promote Japanese coal technology internationally. That is to kind of internationalize the fact that Japan would be significantly increasing its emissions. So once again, it's a non-answer. But I think what it demonstrates is when those
pocketbook issues or domestic issues take precedence every time.
Yes? Kevin?
Thank you. Kevin Massey with the Energy Program here at Brookings. Thank you for your presentations and your perspectives so far. My question also relates to climate. Charlie mentioned the Sokolo-Pakola-Sokolo wedges, and it was clear even before Fukushima that by any measure the global economy was not meeting its stated climate targets. And if you'd sat around in early 2011 and had tried to devise a scheme or a scenario under which the necessary technologies were developed to address global warming, you would probably have to say that something massive would have to happen. Some one major economy would have to find itself in a position where it would have to divert billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of investment into green technology to bring down the cost, to increase the distribution and adoption of those technologies. So it seems, obviously, Fukushima was a disaster by every measure. But in the wake of that, in the wake of the nuclear discussion now in Japan, it seems like there is a platform for a country that is on the cusp of or in the position where it can allocate hundreds of billions of dollars, the necessary hundreds of billions of dollars, to renewable energy development. Is there any way, I'd be interested in the views of the panel on this, is there any way that Japan's situation could be seen as an opportunity for the global renewable energy industry? And to Llewellyn's last point, the link between climate and competitiveness as a source of future competitiveness for a global economy that has to become lower carbon if it's going to be around.
Thank you very much. Before you answer that question, I would like to take two more questions just to make sure time is beginning to run short. I have two hands here, one right next to you, sir, and then the other person behind in the row behind. And then I'll ask the panelists to be very concise in their answers so we can then go to other people as well. So I think he already has the microphone. Yes, sir?
So we've talked a lot about the economic and environmental costs. There is also a geopolitical cost to importing a lot of energy. I would like it if some of you could address that.
Thank you.
Steve Winters, local researcher. I'll make this short. Recently, a court in the U.S. has overturned the ruling's decision of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission here on the grounds that you just can't postpone dealing with the how to dispose of the spent fuel on the assumption that decades from now we'll find some solution to this. So I'd heard the head commissioner speak on this, and of course she's quite perturbed by that development. But obviously this is the same situation in Japan with the spent fuel rods and so forth and so on that we hear about at Fukushima. In fact, the real danger of Fukushima is probably what might happen if they have another major earthquake there and that pool collapses and gets on fire and so forth and so on. So the question is, here for decades we have said, okay, we're going to find some technical solution to what to do with all the spent fuel. But we haven't gotten it yet. But, you know, technology will find a solution. And so we're going to go ahead with the nuclear program on the assumption that someday we're going to find a technical solution. And my family worked for decades at Hanford facility in the U.S. trying to figure out a way to deal with our spent fuel, and they never found it. So the question is, on that line of reasoning, the argument against the renewables is, well, they haven't quite become expensive. But what I particularly want to, honestly speaking, if you think about it, what is more likely that if the same, and to connect to this question, if the same effort were put in to advancing the technology on renewables and so forth and so on, that would be necessary to solve another technical problem, what to do with all the spent fuel, which is more likely to succeed? And I don't think anybody could honestly say it isn't more likely that effort put into renewables would succeed.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. So very concise answers from the panelists, please, and then we'll go to one last question at least.
Geopolitics, I think it's a very serious issue. If Japan is importing more oil, more coal, and more natural gas,
if Japan is importing all three major fossil fuels in greater quantities, this is occurring at a time of growing Chinese bellicosity about sea lanes in the South China Sea, I would be deeply worried as a Japan foreign policy strategist that my country is going to become even more dependent on fuel that may be subject to political disruptions by a potential adversary.
So mainly, so I would like to make a comment to the renewable expansion as pushing the innovations, opportunities like that. Maybe yes, from the one aspect. But on the other hand, for pushing innovation, we have to facilitate industrial activity in Japan as well. So, yeah, so firstly, so from the economic perspective, in generally, so we have a lot of problems, energy problem, and the higher yen appreciation, and the competitiveness of other, mainly the Asian countries. Under such a kind of situation, we have to keep our living, the industrial activities like that. So we have to introduce a balanced answer to give an answer to such a kind of complicated situation. So we would like to push new industry through the renewable expansion like that. So because of that, the strategy, of course, mentioned on the amount of the coming investment to push renewable or energy savings like that. So we would like to introduce such a kind of effect, of course. But, we have a lot of problems. We have to find a solution. And regarding a geopolitical risk, yes, that's a very serious problem, as the Dr. Ebinja mentioned. So because of that, we talk with American friends to introduce LNG. Now, of course, Russia, Australia is the way we will be able to pass the Strait of Malacca. Also, the Middle East situation will likely give a serious impact on Japanese economy as well as other East Asian countries as well. So we have to take it seriously, that we have to discuss how to introduce a robust energy supply structure over the world. That's one of the big dilemma. So we frequently have a discussion with American friends how to manage this problem. This problem is not only for Japan, but also other Asian Pacific countries are facing similar kind of problem. So because of that, nuclear is one of the solutions, and renewable may be one of the solutions. We have to see the whole problem. The originally, why Japan started to introduce nuclear is from the geopolitical situation, geopolitical problem, no question about that.
I just would add to all of that that, you know, we're looking at an international system which is going nuclear, in at least in the production of power, with a nuclear renaissance around the world, not in the United States, obviously, because of cheap gas and for a lot of other reasons. But I think Brookings has just done or about to release a study, and I want to step on your toes, and I'd like to hear about it, but apparently a study of the capability of emerging of countries and economies and governments in developing countries that want nuclear power, the capabilities they have to maintain the safety culture, to provide the expertise, to manage safely run nuclear power plants. And if that is de minimis and the United States and Japan are not at the table and the Russians are selling it, what kind of world do you get? But I think it's a very interesting, you might want to comment a little bit on that, Charlie.
Just very quickly, that's exactly what our study shows. It's focused primarily on the Middle East and some bordering countries to the Middle East, but it basically shows there is no technical capacity at the sufficient level to run these, and if they aren't run by the international vendors who have historically been in the forefront of safe operation and dealing with issues relating to waste and security, it's not a pleasant world to think about.
And I would submit that in a dangerous world with terrorist organizations and terrorist networking and all of that, that we could have a nightmare scenario in the international system in the next 20 years if this is the future.
Okay. So I would like to for you to make your question, please.
My name is Ushijima from JBIC, and my question is relating to the regulatory issues as also the lessons from Fukushima. And I understand the three different bodies in Japan has completed their review of the Fukushima events, and now there is several findings. And so I guess in the future, the Japanese government or regulatory body will say something based on those findings. And at the same time, I think when we discuss the role of the nuclear power and also the public acceptance in the Japanese society, probably we had better discuss about what is the new regulatory system. And honestly speaking, probably there is some general distrust toward the government as well as the regulatory system so far. So now the Japanese government decide to set up the new regulatory body, but probably the government as well as the regulatory body need to talk to the Japanese people, and then, increase their public acceptance of the safety of the nuclear issues. So I want to know, so that is my basic understanding. And so what I want to know is actually, what is the to Okuya-san, what is the government's plan in that regards? And also, I want to know the other panelist's opinion to the extent possible. Is there any possibility between Japan and the United States to work with in that area? Because I understand you have NRC, a very robust regulatory body, and also you have the association among the operators. So there are the three dimensions, regulatory, operator, and manufacturers. So for those three dimensions, how this our two countries can work together?
Thank you so much. Such an excellent question. Less than 1 minute left for our panelists to address it. So whoever would like to take it and start peeling the onion for us.
So thank you very much. And this question is related to the Maria-san's question regarding how to build a public credibility on the nuclear issues. This is a personal view. After 3 miles, the United States introduced a lot of way. Introduced input systems like that. And we Japanese also believed that we learned a lot of things from the American experience after the 3 miles. But now we recognize we have to strengthen the communication with the public. And we succeeded in introducing a new regulatory authority. And that committee has a very independent position from the cabinet to receive the credibility from the public. But maybe we need a time to build the credibility to the regulatory agency firstly. And also we have to strengthen we have to introduce a new way to communicate with the public about not only nuclear but also other area. Actually, DPJ government also make a lot of effort try to introduce a national dialogue style to discuss about the nuclear energy policies like that. We tried various things. The right or wrong, no one has an answer now. But we are trying and we have to push. And this area is one of the most a promising area to make a cooperation with the United States.
Thank you so much. We really are out of time, but if you, Dr. Hughes, if you want to make a super fast comment, because they're about to kick us out,
It'll be very fast.
Okay.
So the typical model for regulating industries in Japan has not been an independent regulatory authority. And the Fair Trade Commission, if you're talking about antitrust, is an occupation import, which has historically been extremely weak within Japan. There is an example of a successful independent regulatory body which was established in the last 10 years, though, and that's the Financial Supervisory Agency. So to my mind, what you need to look for is the number of personnel, but also what the incentives and, for those who are working within the organization itself actually are. So in addition to, you know, talking to colleagues in the U.S. and so on and so forth, there are some interesting lessons, perhaps, to learn how the FSA in Japan managed to achieve a relative degree of independence. Perhaps there's something to take from that for the nuclear regulation as well.
Thank you so much. I would like to ask you to please join me in thanking the panelists. They've done a terrific job. Thank you.